Question I'd like to consider today is God real? Is God real? Now, there are a couple of ways to answer this question, and they're pretty obvious. Yes, God is real, and no, God is not real. And there's probably a third way to answer it, which is, what do you mean by real? Well, perhaps you're not surprised that at least one of the answers to this question is yes. Yes, God is real, because after all, we're sitting as a church today, and the church exists to worship God. So, of course, since we're all rational people here today, we would expect that somebody standing up here might believe in the reality of God. It would seem a natural prerequisite, I suppose. Otherwise, you wouldn't get the gig. So, yes, God is real. I want to affirm that. But the more intriguing question, I think, is why? Why do I say God is real? What's the basis for my assertion that God is real? Well, first off, let's look at this fellow Thomas about whom we've heard in today's Bible reading. I want to look at Thomas because here is one character in the Bible who seemed to have trouble believing what others around him believed. Who is Thomas? Well, as we were told earlier, he's one of the followers of Jesus. He's been travelling around Palestine for the last 3 or 4 years with Jesus, listening to him, seeing the amazing things. And in the end, he's stood on the sidelines while Jesus was arrested and put to death. And the soldiers took Jesus' body down from the cross and placed it in a tomb. Now, there are four different accounts in the Bible about what happens next. And in some matters they agree, and in other matters they disagree. They all agree on one central idea, though, and that is that Jesus died, that he came back to life, and that he appeared to some of his followers in the days after his death. On other matters, there's less agreement. For example, none of the writers appears to have been too concerned on the timing of events. And that's because life in the culture of Palestine didn't follow a schedule like our lives do today. Especially in the Western world, we seem to be addicted to scheduling. We have clocks everywhere. Not only are they on our walls, but they're also on our wrists, they're on our phones, they're on the dashboards of our cars, they're on the fronts or the tops of buildings, they're announced on the radio between every song, and they're in the bottom right-hand corner of our computers, unless you have a Mac, where it's top right. Carol, are you the only one with a Mac? Gary's got one too, okay. Top right-hand corner and a Mac. Unless you've moved it, which I think you can. You certainly can with a PC. You can do everything with a PC. No, never mind. If you try to put the schedule of these four biblical accounts together, you've got to say that Jesus is dying on a Thursday so that he can rise on a Sunday because of the conflicts about the timing. And I think that we should point this out to the government because that way we'd get an extra holiday at Easter time. But I think the point I want to make is that the timing of events isn't important to the writers of the Bible. They lived in a society that was quite unlike our own in this respect, and a few others as well. Because we find it hard to think about a culture in which time is something that's just in the background. I know I find it hard to think of such a culture. I was brought up in that old school which was taught that punctuality is a virtue. And I reckon the great advantage of mobile phones is that I can ring ahead and explain why I'm 5 minutes late for the meeting. Of course, when I arrive at the meeting 5 minutes late, I'm still earlier than half the attendees, most of whom drift in during the next 20 minutes without any apparent conscious awareness that they're doing something wrong. And of course, that's my point. They have no conscious awareness of doing anything wrong because they don't think they are doing anything wrong. The idea of strictly adhering to a schedule is not a problem for them, it's a problem for me. When Judy and I lived in Hong Kong, I learned a very useful Cantonese phrase, gum sung ha. It's a bit like ish in English. When I would ask a Chinese friend or a colleague when we should meet, they would often offer a time and add gum sung ha. So 12 o'clock became 12 o'clock ish. In time, of course, I got used to being the first to arrive everywhere. The simple truth seemed to be that my Chinese friends placed a different value on time compared to me and my Western ways. Now, I'm belabouring this point because I think we shall understand this character of Thomas a bit better if we understand, or try to see at least, how he would have been understood by the people around him. So what happens? Well, according to John, the writer of the fourth version of this event and the version that we heard read to us today, Jesus appears first to Mary Magdalene and then second to all the disciples except for Thomas, because Thomas is somewhere else. He mustn't have got the email. Jesus shows the disciples his wounds and the wounds in his hands and his side, and then he says, "Just as the Father sent me, I send you." And I think there's a connection between Jesus showing them his wounds and this phrase, "Just as the Father sent me, I send you." How does the Father send Jesus? He sends him to be wounded. The Father sends Jesus to take sides with the wounded, the unjustly treated. He sends Jesus to be a victim of injustice. He sends Jesus to be a scapegoat, but a victim who is not conquered by the injustice. Now, there's much more to be said about this, but I want to move on to the character of Thomas and see his reaction when he hears the news, because during the next week, the disciples bump into Thomas and they tell him they've seen Jesus. And now Thomas, he doesn't believe them. He says, "Unless I see the nail holes in his hands," probably here, "put my finger in the nail holes and stick my hand in his side, I won't believe it." And in that phrase, Thomas expresses our modern dilemma. Thomas wants evidence. He wants facts. He wants proof. It's like Thomas has been spirited back from the future. Because isn't that what we hear around us today? "I won't believe in God until I have proof. I want evidence. Show me the facts that God exists, and then I'll believe. Until then, I'm an atheist." Well, there's a logical flaw in this position, by the way. The atheist who says that God does not exist because there is no evidence cannot show the evidence that God does not exist.
What did he say? Did he say the atheist who says that God does not exist because there is no evidence cannot show the evidence that God does not exist? Yes, I think he did say that, dear.
You cannot find facts to prove God exists. That is correct. But also, you cannot find facts to prove that God does not exist. That is also correct. "I believe God exists" is a statement of faith. And "I believe God does not exist" is also a statement of faith. Lacking the evidence one way or another, people say what they believe to be true, because neither statement can be scientifically demonstrated to be true or false. And so we come to Thomas. Why do I say he's back from the future? Well, he doesn't arrive in a DeLorean with a flux capacitor in the back. But Thomas, more than anyone else in this story, says what most of us living in the Western world in the 21st century would probably say. "Show me the evidence, then I'll believe it." Well, just in case you missed it in this morning's Bible reading, the week after Jesus appears to the first lot, he appears again. The story says Jesus came through locked doors. That's pretty cool. Thomas, of course, knows that dead people can't come through locked doors. And yet he apparently has pretty compelling evidence that his belief system might have a few holes in it. Jesus, who I reckon is the master of many things, including irony, says to Thomas, "Take your finger and examine my hands. Take your hand and stick it in my side. Don't be unbelieving, believe." Well, at this, Thomas does not do what I expect him to do. If he is the rational, scientifically minded, evidence-based kind of a guy that he puts himself out to be, he will do what Jesus suggests. He'll take hold of Jesus' hands, he'll inspect the holes where the nails went in, he'll look for the rope burns on his wrists, he'll do as Jesus suggests, he'll stick his hand in his side. But Thomas doesn't do what we expect. He just says, "My Lord and my God." It's pretty clear that in this moment, Thomas realises that his way of understanding the world is not enough. Whether he inspects Jesus' wounds or not, There is no way to explain in a logical, factual way what is happening to him right now. A dead man has walked through doors. It just doesn't make sense. But he can't deny his experience. Something has happened here beyond logic. Something outside of his understanding of the world. It makes no sense. Yet it's his experience. Is God real? Yes, God is real in the experience of millions of people down through history before and after Jesus. One might even say that the most compelling evidence for the reality of God is the never-ending search by human beings for an understanding of what God is. In the book of Ecclesiastes, which was written a bit over 2,000 years ago, the writer observes that God has set eternity in the hearts of men. In the 18th century, the French philosopher Blaise Pascal put it a little differently. He wrote, "There is a God-shaped hole in the heart of every man." And in the 20th century, the French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre revised the saying to reflect how much had changed in less than 200 years. Sartre's version was, "There is a God-shaped hole in the heart of man where the divine used to be." Some would suggest that this continuous awareness of the need for God is itself evidence for God. But in using the idea of evidence, we can easily fall into the world's trap, because if God is real, God must be something quite beyond evidence. And that's why an answer to the question, is God real, I might answer with this other question, what do you mean by real? God doesn't exist in any way that we can think of existence. You see, the evidentiary road to understanding God, the attempts to understand God by looking for evidence always leads us down roads that are limited by our own understandings. In other words, we shall create God in ways that are limited by our own limited understandings. Or to put it another way, we create God in our own likeness. And it's not a God that we create, it's an idol. As surprised as I was to find myself agreeing with one of Australia's most conservative churchmen, I found myself agreeing with the Anglican Archbishop of Sydney during the week. In his Easter address, Dr. Peter Jensen described atheism as a form of idolatry in which we worship ourselves. A bit harsh, but anyway, got him into the news. I'd hope to say it a bit more kindly. That is, if we only have an idea of God that is limited by what we can explain, then we're worshipping something of our own making. And that, a God of our own making, is the definition of an idol. So no, God does not exist in any way that we can explain with our limited understanding. Of course, we try to describe God as best we can. We have many names and many adjectives for God, but we need to agree that none of them is in any way adequate. Now, I'm sure some of us, schooled as we are in post-Enlightenment rationality, are saying, "But Philip, you're suggesting we just make mindless, irrational commitments to something that is nothing." Well, no. I'm suggesting that in the absence of conclusive evidence one way or another, each of us has a decision to make. We can choose to be an atheist. We can say, in the absence of conclusive evidence one way or another, I choose to believe that God does not exist. Or we can choose to believe. We can equally say, in the absence of conclusive evidence one way or another, I choose to believe that God does exist. And maybe you will say, since I am a rational thinking human being, I will always adopt the first position, that is the atheist position, that I will not believe things for which there is no conclusive evidence. Well, if you want to take that position, you'll be out of step with most of the world's scientists, who frequently believe things for which there is no conclusive evidence. You see, we all begin with statements of belief. Take one of the great theories of the 20th century. One aspect of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity is that, follow me closely, rotating body warps and twists the fabric that combines the three dimensions of space and the fourth dimension of time. Now, this theory, that space-time is bent by the rotation of the Earth, that was the summary statement, space-time is bent by the rotation of the Earth, this theory was not proven by conclusive evidence until 2004. NASA scientists measured two satellites orbiting the Earth and found that they did shift as the planet pulled on space. They needed instruments that could measure the orbits of the satellites to within millimetres, and such instruments didn't exist until the 21st century. So from 1915, when Einstein first proposed his general theory of relativity, until 2004, scientists the world over believed in the theory without conclusive evidence. 100 years of simple belief without conclusive evidence. Someone asked me years ago why I believed in God, and my answer wasn't well thought out, but it turned out to be the most accurate thing I could say even today. I said, I find it easier to believe in God than not to believe in God. Now, maybe it's because there's a God-shaped hole in my heart that only a belief in God can fill. Maybe it's because there are so many wonderful coincidences in my life that it's easier to believe in a divine purpose than in coincidence. Maybe it's because there seems to me to be something beyond the natural and human in the way I've experienced and seen love and grace in action. Maybe it's because I find it easier to have faith in a life of meaning than in a life of meaninglessness. Maybe it's because I find it easier to believe we are put here for a purpose and not merely to be born, live pointless lives, and disappear after we die. There's so much in our world that makes no sense and about which I have doubts and uncertainties. Richard Dawkins might call me a fool for thinking that some of this could be God at work, but I think I'm no less of a fool than the one who thinks that it is not God at work. But back to Thomas. We tend to think that Thomas's problem was that he had doubts. I think that's to misunderstand him a bit. I think that Thomas's problem was that he was a 21st century man living in a first century world. Like so many of us today, we say we cannot believe in the things that we cannot see, even though we are blind to the fact that we live every day taking for granted a whole range of things we can neither see nor sense. I reckon that in that moment when Jesus appeared, Thomas's worldview changed forever. Not because he had some new facts, not because experience in that moment was something, but because the experience he had in that moment was something beyond belief. At least beyond belief as he had experienced it up until then. Thomas had an experience that transcended reality. It was an out-of-this-world experience. It was an ecstatic experience. The word ecstatic comes from a Greek word meaning to stand outside yourself. Ecstatic, to stand outside yourself. And that is what I believe happened to Thomas. He had an understanding of himself and his world that was shaken apart by the experience of Jesus returning as if from the dead. It caused him to stand outside himself, or at least to stand outside his understanding of the world and how it works. You see, Thomas's response is not to go over and check out the facts. He doesn't put his fingers in Jesus' wounds. He simply stands there and says, "My Lord and my God." Some may suggest that Jesus walking through walls somehow proves that he's God. And if only Jesus would suddenly appear in the middle aisle today, we would all believe he is God. But that's just being impressed by signs and wonders, like being able to skin a banana and find it's already cut up inside. Now let's be impressed for sure, just like we are impressed by those magic tricks. How did she get the scarf in the bread? I don't know. But this kind of belief is not the same as faith. I just read a book called The Case for God, written by Karen Armstrong. And she said something about faith that I found really helpful, and remarkably, although perhaps not remarkable because of the way God works, I saw it quoted in an article in Tuesday's Age. She said, "Belief is a commitment, not a proposition. Faith, as in, I have faith in you, is an expression of confidence, not an assertion of the existence of something. Belief in God is a truth which cannot easily be put into words, and which can only be fully understood through long experience, rather like the love of a parent for their child growing into adulthood." Can we prove the existence of love? Can we prove the existence of beauty or compassion or grace? We may be able to see the results of love, but love itself is something outside of scientific rationality. The other terrific insight in Karen Armstrong's statement lies in her statement that faith is a truth which can only be fully understood through long experience. Long experience. And here, I think, is the real reason that many people in the world are unsure about the reality of God. They haven't had much experience of God. They may have had some idea of God at some time in their lives. They may have believed in God as a child, but they don't have any long experience of God. And faith takes practice. When I was at school, I was rather fond of debating. This will surprise you all, I'm sure. We had regular competitions with other schools. We would practice our arguments during lunchtimes and after school. The more we debated, the better we got. Practice made perfect. Well, almost. I think we got beaten once by Brisbane Grammar. I was at Brisbane Boys College. Debating was optional for the boys. Rugby union was not. Everyone in the school was required to wear the striped football jersey and play rugby union. This meant there were 8 teams in the senior school, and I was in the 8s. Now, the thing about the 8s was that only one other school in the competition, namely Nudgee College, where Akamanis went, but not at the same time as me, had 8 teams. Only Nudgee had 8 teams. And that meant we played only one game for the whole year. Brisbane Boys College versus Nudgee College. Now, despite the lack of competition, the boys in the Nudgee College 8s practiced for the whole season. They would have practice matches against their higher teams every week. The match between Brisbane Boys College 8s and the Nudgee College 8s was the second last fixture of the season. It was played on a Wednesday afternoon at Nudgee. The Brisbane Boys College 8s practiced together as a team for the first time on the Monday before the Wednesday. We practiced again on the Tuesday before the Wednesday. Armed with all the benefits of 2 practice hours, we confronted the Nudgee College 8s, who had been practicing all season. The score was 75 points to nil. You can guess who won. We realised that to be good at rugby union, you had to practice rugby union. Well, faith is like that. It's a gift for sure. It's given to everyone. There is a God-shaped hole in the heart of every man and woman. But if you want to use this gift, I think you have to exercise it. In 1910, G.K. Chesterton wrote a book called What's Wrong with the World, which included perhaps his most famous quote. He said, "The Christian ideal has not been tried and found wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried." Faith is a choice. It's a choice I made as a child to express confidence in God. It's been a choice to practice that faith or confidence as days and years go by. And just as our muscles grow stronger, the more we exercise them, our faith grows stronger, the more we practice it. And it's true whether our faith is in the reality of God or our faith is in the idea that God is not real. Practicing either form of faith will make that faith stronger. In other words, if we spend our whole life practicing to be an atheist, we'll probably get pretty good at it. Maybe not as good as Richard Dawkins, but good enough to proudly boast about our atheism. Or if we spend our whole life practicing faith in God, we might start to get more and more confident about the reality of God. Finally, there's a postscript to the story of Thomas that probably most of us don't know, unless you happen to come from India. Just one or two. Let me quote from a 1953 edition of Time magazine. When 16th century European priests arrived in southern India to introduce Christianity, they were told that a more famed missionary, Christian missionary, had been there first. In the districts of Travancore and Cochin, there was already a community of Indian Christians with a tradition of loose communion with the Roman Catholic Church. The man who first converted them, the Indians said, was none other than St. Thomas, the Apostle, the Doubting Thomas, who arrived in India aboard a Roman trading vessel in 52 AD. Whether St. Thomas actually preached under the palm trees of Travancore and Cochin is a point that historians have neither proved nor disproved. But nowadays, that's in 1953, there were 2,357,000 Indian Christians in the area. Well, here's another thing no one can prove, one way or the other. We have only the evidence of legend, but what a lovely legend. If Thomas had doubts about Jesus, he did not have them for long. Thomas exercised his faith in the best way one can, by living it. A life of practicing his faith. Thomas made the choice. He chose faith in God. Each one of us has the same choice. There's a God-shaped hole in our hearts. What's yours filled with?